Welcome to a deep dive into Britain between the wars.
Ah, yes.
That fascinating but often turbulent period from 1920 to 1939.
Right.
You wanted to understand the social and economic challenges of this era?
Yes.
And we've got a real mix of sources to help us do just that.
Okay.
History texts, parliamentary debates,
sure.
newspaper articles. Mm. Even a political cartoon.
Wow.
We'll be uncovering stories of hardship and resilience.
Right.
From a riot in Glasgow to a town devastated by industry.
Okay.
But we'll also see new ideas emerging.
Uh-huh.
Ideas that would change the way we think about economics and government.
That's an interesting period.
It is.
Yeah. It all starts with the shadow of World War I.
Okay.
Britain emerged victorious, but deeply scarred.
Okay. So let's start there.
Sure.
Over 750,000 British soldiers dead.
Yes.
Millions wounded.
Huh?
A national debt of almost £8 billion by 1920.
Goodness.
How did that impact daily life for people?
Well, imagine a nation trying to rebuild.
Right.
While carrying this enormous weight.
Yeah.
Prime Minister Lloyd George had promised a land fit for heroes.
Mm.
But the economic realities were harsh.
Right.
Industries that had boomed during the war.
Okay.
Shipbuilding, textiles, coal.
Yeah.
Suddenly faced plummeting demand.
I see.
And those returning soldiers.
Right.
Many struggled to find jobs in this shifting landscape.
So Lloyd George's promise kind of backfired.
Well, there were efforts to address the social fallout.
Okay.
Voting rights were expanded. Education improved.
Right.
Unemployment and health insurance were introduced.
Wow.
But these reforms weren't cheap.
Yeah.
The government also had to cut spending to tackle that massive debt.
Right.
And those cuts later fueled a lot of the unrest we'll be exploring.
It's like they were trying to balance on a tightrope.
Yes.
And the ground kept shifting beneath them.
Absolutely.
Speaking of shifting ground, one of the most dramatic events of this era has to be the general strike of 1926.
Oh, for sure.
What led to millions of workers walking off the job?
Let's focus on coal.
Okay.
It was Britain's industrial heart. But by the 1920s, output was falling.
Right.
And miners were facing pay cuts and longer hours.
Mm-hmm.
The government was caught in the middle.
I see.
Trying to balance the interests of mine owners, workers, and a nation desperate for economic stability.
And that's where Churchill's decision to reintroduce the gold standard comes in, right?
Exactly.
Aimed at stability.
Yes.
But didn't quite work out as planned.
Repegging the pound to gold.
Okay.
Was supposed to make Britain more attractive to foreign investors.
Right.
But it actually backfired.
Mm.
It made British goods more expensive abroad.
Yeah.
Hurting exports and further squeezing industries like coal.
So unintended consequences strike again.
Right.
And this tension over coal, the falling wages, that's what sparks the general strike.
It's the flashpoint.
Okay.
The mine owners refuse to budge on pay cuts.
Mm.
The Miners' Federation threatens action.
Right.
And in a powerful display of solidarity, the Trade Union Congress, the TUC, calls for a general strike.
Wow.
We're talking millions of workers across various industries walking out.
Early.
Transportation, printing, even some power stations shut down.
The country must have ground to a halt.
It did.
What was the atmosphere like?
Think organized chaos.
Okay.
The government, fearing anarchy.
Right.
Invoked emergency powers.
I see.
They set up the Organization for the Maintenance of Supplies.
What was that?
Volunteers.
Okay.
Often middle class folks.
Uh-huh.
Keeping essential services running.
I can only imagine the tension.
Yeah.
People on both sides.
Yeah.
Feeling like their way of life is at stake.
Absolutely.
Were there any specific incidents that captured this tension?
Oh, absolutely.
Like what?
In Glasgow, there were riots.
Wow.
The government, led by the conservative prime minister, Stanley Baldwin, denounced the strikers as revolutionaries, even comparing them to Lenin's Bolsheviks.
Really?
To counter what they saw as strike propaganda, they even launched a special newspaper.
Okay.
The British Gazette.
The British Gazette.
Yes.
Edited by Winston Churchill, right?
That's right.
What kind of arguments did it make?
Churchill, always the wordsmith, painted a dramatic picture.
Okay.
He called the strike a challenge to parliamentary government.
Right.
And insisted the government would not be coerced. He appealed to patriotism, urging Britons to stand firm against those trying to disrupt the nation's recovery.
Okay.
as a powerful piece of propaganda.
So a real battle for hearts and minds being waged in the press.
Absolutely.
Did the Gazette have any real impact?
It's difficult to measure its direct impact.
Okay.
But it certainly reflected the government's anxieties.
Right.
They even printed the paper on smaller sheets.
Real.
So it could be read more easily in the dimmed light of street lamps during blackouts.
Mm.
It gives you a sense of how seriously they took this threat.
It's fascinating to think of something as simple as paper size being part of this larger struggle.
Uh-huh.
So with all this tension,
yeah,
how did the strike eventually end?
After 9 days,
okay,
the TUC, right, facing mounting pressure and dwindling resources,
mm-hmm,
backed down.
So they gave in.
The miners, however, were left to fight on alone for another 7 months.
So the TUC backs down, the miners are isolated. What were the lasting consequences of this?
Well, for the unions, it was a crushing defeat.
Mm.
It solidified a sense of disillusionment,
okay,
among the working class.
Yeah.
And significantly weakened the union movement's power in Britain,
right,
for the coal industry.
Uh-huh.
There were some gains in productivity.
I see.
But at a huge human cost.
And all this against the backdrop of a global economy that was about to take a nosedive.
Yes.
The Great Depression hit Britain hard.
It did.
And nowhere was that more evident than in Jarrow.
Right.
What made this shipbuilding town a symbol of the Depression's devastating impact?
Jarrow's story is tragically simple.
Okay.
But powerful.
Yeah.
Shipbuilding was its lifeblood.
Right.
And when orders dried up,
mm-hmm,
the town was left reeling.
Wow.
By 1934, unemployment had reached a staggering 72%.
Goodness.
People were losing their homes.
Oh, no.
Families were going hungry.
Wow.
It was a stark illustration.
Yeah.
Of how regional inequality magnified the impact of the Depression.
Our sources really highlight those contrasting perspectives on what was happening in Jarrow.
Yeah.
On the one hand, yeah, you have Walter Runciman, mm-hmm, the president of the Board of Trade,
right,
suggesting that Jarrow should make a clean sweep,
mm,
and attract new industries.
Yes. And it's hard not to hear a disconnect,
yeah,
between his words and the reality on the ground.
Right.
He talks about attracting new industries.
Mm-hmm.
But to people in Jarrow, that must have sounded like a distant dream.
I can imagine.
What new industries were going to magically appear in a town with no infrastructure,
right,
a devastated workforce, and a global economy in free fall.
Then there's Sir John Jarvis,
yes,
the local MP, who tries to help by buying ships to be broken up for scrap.
Okay.
Well-intentioned.
Yeah.
But was it just a Band-Aid solution?
It certainly provided some temporary relief.
Okay.
Putting a few men back to work.
Yeah.
But breaking up ships for scrap,
right,
was a far cry from building them.
Hmm.
It underscored the sense of decline,
uh-huh,
of a proud industry being dismantled.
And then there's the writer J.B. Priestley,
yes,
who visited Jarrow and was so appalled by what he saw that he called it a blot on civilization.
A strong statement.
It sparked outrage from local officials.
Of course.
Who saw it as an insult.
Well, I think Priestley was trying to shake people out of their complacency.
Okay.
He wasn't just criticizing Jarrow.
Right.
He was criticizing a system that allowed such poverty and despair to exist.
Hmm.
He later wrote, "This is the problem of Jarrow. And the problem of Jarrow is the problem of England."
So he's connecting this very specific local crisis,
yes,
to a wider national crisis.
Exactly.
And Jarrow's response to this crisis is fascinating.
It is.
They organized a march,
right,
the Jarrow Crusade,
mm-hmm,
to petition Parliament for relief.
Yes.
What made this different from other hunger marches of the time?
It was meticulously planned.
Really?
They wanted to present themselves as respectable citizens pleading for a lifeline.
I see.
Not as desperate radicals.
Okay.
Ellen Wilkinson,
mm-hmm,
a fiery labor MP who represented Jarrow,
uh-huh,
was instrumental in shaping the march's message.
Right.
They called it a crusade.
Yeah.
And they emphasized their unity.
Okay.
Even conservatives in Jarrow supported the march.
So it was a deliberate strategy to appeal to a wider audience.
Yes.
To garner sympathy rather than provoke fear. They wanted to show the human face of the Depression,
yeah,
to remind people in London that behind the statistics were real people.
Yes.
Real family suffering.
Absolutely.
And they didn't just march.
Right.
They marched 300 miles.
Wow.
200 men,
mm,
chosen out of 1,100 volunteers.
Right.
Carrying a petition signed by 11,000 Jarrow residents.
That's a lot.
That's a powerful image.
It is.
What kind of reception did they get along the route?
There was widespread public sympathy.
Okay.
People donated food.
Uh-huh.
Clothing.
Yeah.
even money.
Wow.
But the government remained largely dismissive.
Hmm.
They viewed such demonstrations as a nuisance.
Okay.
A distraction from their efforts to manage the national economy.
You can almost sense the government's frustration,
yeah.
but also their fear.
Uh-huh.
Here's this group of unemployed men
right.
marching across the country,
yeah.
highlighting the government's failures.
Exactly.
What was their reaction when the marchers arrived in London?
Well, they certainly couldn't ignore them.
Right.
The marchers arrived in London on November 1st, 1936.
Okay.
And Ellen Wilkinson delivered a powerful speech in Hyde Park.
Mm-hmm.
She declared
okay.
Jarrow as a town has been murdered.
Wow.
And she placed the blame squarely on government policies.
I see.
She accused the government of sacrificing Jarrow
uh-huh.
for the sake of national economic indicators.
It must have been a powerful moment.
It was.
Those 200 marchers.
Yes.
Standing in the heart of the Capitol.
Right.
Their voices echoing Wilkinson's accusations.
Yes.
Did they get to present their petition?
Oh, they did.
Okay.
They marched to Parliament and handed over their petition,
mm-hmm.
signed by thousands of their fellow townspeople.
Okay.
But the government offered no concrete help.
Mm.
No solutions to Jarrow's plight.
So the marchers return home defeated but not broken.
Yes.
This is a poignant story.
It is.
But was it a victory or a defeat?
That's a good question.
Did the Jarrow Crusade have any lasting impact?
It's a complex question.
Okay.
On the one hand, they failed to achieve their immediate goal of securing aid for Jarrow.
Hmm.
But their story resonated with people across the country.
Yeah.
It forced the nation to confront the human cost of the Depression.
Right.
The uneven impact of economic policies.
So perhaps a moral victory. They raised awareness.
Yeah.
They challenged the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
But it also raises a bigger question.
Okay.
Could the government have done more?
Hmm.
Was there a different path forward?
Yeah.
A different way of thinking about economics.
Okay.
That might have helped places like Jarrow.
That's where John Maynard Keynes enters the picture.
Okay.
He was an economist who challenged the traditional thinking
mm-hmm.
that dominated economic policy during the Depression.
Right.
Back then, the prevailing wisdom was for yeah. governments to balance their budgets.
Okay.
Even during a downturn.
Right.
Keynes argued
mm-hmm.
that this was exactly the wrong approach.
So instead of tightening their belts, he thought governments should loosen them, spend more, even if it meant going into debt.
Precisely.
Wow.
Keynes believed
yeah.
that governments should actively intervene
okay.
to stimulate demand and create jobs.
Right.
Even if it meant deficit spending.
Okay.
He argued that by putting money in people's pockets,
uh-huh.
you could kickstart the economy and get things moving again.
Okay, so let's apply that to what we've been talking about.
Sure.
How might Keynes have viewed the government's handling of the general strike or the Jarrow situation?
Well, for starters, he would have likely criticized the decision to return to the gold standard.
Hmm.
He believed that tying the pound to gold artificially restricted the government's ability to manage the economy.
I see.
He might have advocated for more direct government intervention to support struggling industries like coal and shipbuilding.
So instead of telling Jarrow to make a clean sweep,
yeah.
a Keynesian approach might have involved something more proactive.
Yes.
Like investing in retraining programs or public works projects.
Exactly. Keynes believed that government spending, even if it led to short-term deficits,
right.
could have long-term benefits
oh.
by boosting employment and creating a ripple effect throughout the economy.
It makes you wonder if those lessons were learned later on.
Right.
Because Keynesian economics did eventually become quite influential, right?
Yes. After World War II, Keynesian ideas gained traction,
okay.
influencing economic policies in any countries, including Britain.
Mm.
It was almost as if the world had learned a hard lesson from the suffering of the interwar years.
So the Jarrow Crusade, even though it didn't achieve its immediate goals,
right.
perhaps it planted a seed.
It did.
It forced people to rethink those prevailing assumptions about the role of government in a crisis.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah.
The Jarrow Crusade, like so many events of this period,
right.
reveals the human cost of economic policies.
Yeah.
It reminds us that behind the statistics,
okay.
behind the graphs and charts, mm-hmm. are real people, real communities struggling to make ends meet.
And it's a reminder that history isn't just a collection of dates and names.
No.
It's about the stories of ordinary people navigating extraordinary circumstances.
Yes.
Often with courage and resilience.
Absolutely. And I think the story of Britain between the wars.
Right.
With its economic turmoil, its social unrest, its search for solutions, holds valuable lessons for us today as we face our own set of challenges.
It certainly makes you think.
Yes.
What would a Keynesian approach look like in today's world? Mm. Are there parallels to the struggles faced by those Jarrow marchers and the challenges we see around us today?
Those are questions worth pondering.
They are.
And perhaps they'll spark your own deep dive into these fascinating and complex issues.
That'd be great.
What stands out to you as the most enduring legacy of this period? What resonates most strongly?
That's a great question to leave our listener with.
It is.
And as we wrap up this deep dive, I just want to say thank you for joining us on this journey through Britain between the wars.
You're welcome.
We've covered a lot of ground, from the aftermath of World War I to the rise of new economic ideas, from the drama of the general strike to the poignant story of the Jarrow Crusade.
Right.
We hope you've gained some new insights and perhaps even been inspired to learn more.
We do.
It's been a pleasure to explore these sources with you, and most importantly, with our listener.
It has.
We encourage you to keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep seeking those aha moments.
Yes.
After all, as we've seen, history is full of surprises. And there's always more to discover.
Absolutely.